It's nice to see you. This is the first Kol Yom Rishon I've done here, and it's a pleasure to be here. I've begun teaching this year, actually, at Reitz, a chabura about 10, 30 or so, that gets done about midnight on Tuesday nights. So it's the night owl shift. Today we're going to be looking at an upcoming story in the Parsha. It's the story of the sale of Yosef. It's something I've been doing a lot of work on lately, so this will be a sort of compressed version of something I'm working on that's really a much larger series. So we'll see how far we can get. The story of Yosef and his brothers in some way is, it's a very difficult story. It's one of those things that's kind of hard to teach your kids. You can make a musical about it, Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat, but when you strip away all of the fun and the childlike fairy tale aspects of the story, it's really a pretty horrific story. Some brothers jump another brother, kidnap him, throw him in the pit, sell him off into slavery, and the ramifications of it are felt throughout history. Not only does this lead to Yetzias Mitzrayim, to Shibud Mitzrayim, it also leads probably to the division in the kingship between the northern and southern kingdoms. In one way, the story is unique in Tanakh in the sense that you hear a lot about the motivations and the characters and what everybody's thinking. It's a story that's told. Speak louder. It's a story that's told in the greatest detail in a certain way. And yet, I'd like to argue to you that there is a lot of detail that we don't hear, at least explicitly, but is implicit in the text. And I'd like to try to unearth some of that with you today. There are a lot of questions which we can ask, primarily centered, I think, around the question of what was everyone thinking? Exactly what was everyone thinking? What were the brothers thinking? Here they jump another brother, very nearly kill him, throw him in a pit, sell him into slavery. Did they think this was right? Even if they were motivated by anger, jealousy, or a sense of righteous indignation, how could they have done it to their father? What were they thinking? Did they have some way of, in their own minds, how did they sleep at night? How did they rationalize what it was that they were doing? And were they right? Were they wrong? But what were they thinking? What was Yosef thinking in terms of his response to all of this? We don't explicitly know. What was Yaakov thinking? And we're going to look at that question in detail in a moment. I think oftentimes when we think of Yaakov's role in the story, we think of him almost as a benighted old man, unaware, a little bit naive about the tensions that are roiling his family. And Nebuch, you know, he lost his son in a terrible accident. But I think a closer look at Yaakov's perspective reveals something else. I think that there's something else going on with Yaakov, and I think he knows a lot more than he seems to know in the story, and we'll examine that in a moment. And finally, fourth and last but not least, certainly not least, what was God thinking? In this story, we do not get God's response to the story. We have to surmise it. God does not have any explicit response to the story. God does not come out of the clouds and says, I think this is a good thing, I think this is a bad thing. We have to figure it out. Is there a way to figure out what God thinks of all of this? And how do we understand that? So, basically, what was everyone thinking? What were the brothers thinking? What was Yaakov thinking? What was Yosef thinking? What was God thinking? That's basically what we're going to try to look at. I don't know if we'll get to all of it today, but if we don't, these are things that you should be thinking about. What was everybody thinking? Okay, let's begin with Yaakov. What was Yaakov thinking? Can we puncture the view that Yaakov was a benighted old man, unaware, really, what was going on, a bit naive, a little bit out of touch with what was happening with his family, and Nebuch, his favorite son, got ransacked at the last moment? I think this is a popular view, but I don't think it's true. Let's look at the sort of development, if we can, of the story and specifically Yaakov's involvement in the story. Yaakov doesn't really get involved until just about the end. But let's just chart for a moment the build-up of tensions within the family. What's the first thing that happens? First thing that happens that causes tension in the family, according to the Torah, is what? You have it right up here, I think, somewhere, but... And essentially, it's that Yosef is with his brothers, Hayroa et Achav Batzon, v'hu nara b'nei Bilha b'nei Bzilpa, v'yaveh Yosef esti basam ra'al avim. First thing that happens is that Yosef brings back bad reports about his brothers. That's the first thing that causes tension. The next thing is things are exacerbated when Yaakov makes a beautiful coat for Yosef, and at that point, v'yiru echav ki oto ahav avihem mikol achav, v'yisnu oto v'lo yachlu dabro l'shalom. The brothers saw that father loved him more than all the others. They hated him. They couldn't speak peacefully to him. Then, element number three is the first dream. Vayachalom Yosef chalom, and he tells it to his brothers, and they hate him even more for the dream. And what's the dream? The dream is, we were off in the fields, and your stocks started bowing to my stocks. To which the brothers respond, Hamaloch timloch aleinu, imashol timshol banu, are you really going to rule over us? And they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. By the way, so far there's been a consistent trajectory over here. The brothers' response to everything is what? What emotion are they feeling towards Yosef? Hatred. Notice though that they're not feeling another emotion. The other emotion, which you might have expected them to be feeling, which they're not, is what?
Jealousy.
Notice that the Torah makes no reference to jealousy. Torah is only talking about hatred right now. That changes in the fourth dream. And that changes with the fourth element, or the second dream. Here's the second dream. Vayachalom od chalom acher vayisaper le'achav vayomer hinei chalamti chalom od v'nei ha'shemesh vayareach v'achadasar kochavim mishtachavim li. In this dream, the sun and the moon and the sun and the moon and the stars are all bowing to me. He tells this to his father and to his brothers. Vayigar bo aviv vayomer ma chalom azasher chalamta. Father castigates him, is caustic towards him. What is this dream that you have told us? Shall I, my mother and your father, bow down? Notice that that's the beginning of jealousy, right? Now the brothers are jealous of him, and Aviv Shamarat Adavar, which is difficult words to translate. Father, how do you translate those? Aviv Shamarat Adavar and Pshuto Shemekra, dad did what? What? Nothing? Not that he did nothing, Shamarat Adavar means what? He watched over the thing. Now the question is, what does watch over the thing mean? So in your own words, what do you think this means? Kept a lid on it, right? So his dad is trying to keep a lid on the situation. Now if that's what it means, and I do think that's the Pshuto Shemekra what it means, then there's one thing we know for sure at this point, which is dad oblivious to what's going on or not? No, dad is not oblivious to what's going on. He's just become aware, perhaps, but we know that he's now aware of a deep jealousy within the family, and he's specifically trying to keep a lid on things. As a matter of fact, he's, if anything, Rashi suggests, he's trying to portray to the brothers that he doesn't really believe this, right, and that it's not so sure that it's happening.
Is it possible to infer that Yaakov's love of Yosef is as a result of Yosef's report of the evil that his brothers have committed since one pasuk follows the next?
I don't think you can infer it because of one pasuk follows the next. It's a possibility, but I don't think it's a proof. We'll talk a little bit about where that love might come from, but let's just leave it for now. So right now we have jealousy coming in the mix. Strange, because if you were the brothers, when would you have been jealous? Would it have taken you this long to be jealous? When might have you been jealous?
The coat.
I would have been jealous with the coat. Right? Dad makes him a nice coat. I see dad loves him more. I would have been jealous right then. But interestingly, no. They hate him. Their response to father's love is the opposite of love, is hatred. And all of a sudden they're jealous. Why now jealous? What's the difference between jealousy and hatred? What is it that they're seeing now that makes them jealous? So perhaps it's interesting that the jealousy comes after father's response. Not just after the second dream, but after father's response to the second dream. Because there's something in that response that provoked jealousy. Look at the response again. Father is angry at him, says, what's this dream that you've dreamt? Right? While the brothers are jealous, dad is keeping a lid on things. The interesting thing is that Rashi has another interpretation of Shamarat HaDavar. Rashi interprets those words differently based upon a medrash, that it doesn't mean the dad was keeping a lid on things, it means something else. By the way, generally speaking, when you learn medrash, I think that there's a general mistake that people make when they learn medrash. I think it's worthwhile pointing out now, but which is that we often conflate medrash with pshat. That the medrash is saying something, we think the medrash is telling us pshat. It's not true. The medrash is not necessarily trying to tell us pshat. Oftentimes, the medrash is saying, you can figure out pshat, I'm telling you the medrash. In other words, I'm telling you another layer of meaning which you need to understand in relationship to pshat. There's all these weird midrashim, you know, the Bas Paro sends her hand, you know, it's a Fantastic Four, her hand stretches all the way, gets Moshe's teva, comes on back. How do you understand these sort of midrashim? Did it happen in pshat? I mean, if something like that happened in pshat, right? Well, you know, if you were the daughter of Paro, and you're moseying down the Nile for a nice bath, and all of a sudden you see this kid, right? And before you know it, your hand is stretching 40 feet, and you're getting this kid, what would you do next? What? Yes, you would see a doctor. First of all, you'd scream. Okay, you would faint. You would run the other direction as fast as you can. But my arm, look what happened to my arm. It would mess up the whole story, right? So, it would. It's just, how can you understand it? So, I don't think Chazal are telling you that's pshat. What they're telling you is the pshat is the pshat. She sent her maidservant. Another level of meaning is sending the maidservant is like sending her arm. Whatever that means. We can get into that another time. We don't really have time for that right now. But the idea, it's almost like playing piano. I have a pet peeve. I think, you know, the most pernicious book on the Jewish bookshelf, in a certain way, is the Little Medrash Says. Right? You know, you take this book, you read it to your kids, and it sounds like pshat. But it's not pshat. It's like playing piano. If you play piano, your right hand carries the melody, your left hand carries the harmony. If you just listen to the left hand, what does it sound like? It's total nonsense. If you listen to the right hand, at least it sounds like Old MacDonald Had a Farm, or whatever it is you're playing. You put the two together, it sounds very beautiful. It's three-dimensional. If the pshat is the right hand, you know, then Chazal is the left hand. It's the harmony. You have to understand the harmony in relation to pshat. If you don't see them in relation to pshat, it makes no sense. It's completely out in left field. So here, too, I think the pshat is, Aviv Shamarat HaDavar is Aviv Shamarat HaDavar. Dad is keeping a lid on things. But there's a midrashic analysis of Aviv Shamarat HaDavar, which adds another layer of meaning, which interestingly contrasts, as harmony often does, with the primary layer of meaning. That is the following. If you look at Rashi, Rashi says, "Hayamamtinu mitzapem matayavo." He was waiting for it to happen. Aviv Shamarat HaDavar means that his response to the dreams is "Hayamamtinu mitzapem matayavo." He was hoping and waiting for it to happen. Now, notice what that medrash is doing to the pshat. What is the pshat? The pshat. First of all, look at the rest of the pasuk. Vayigar bo aviv. Dad is angry, right? He's caustic. He's upset about this. But Aviv Shamarat HaDavar. Right, he's waiting for it to happen. So, of course, the question is, right? First of all, those two things seem to be at odds. Is he angry, or does he want it to, does he want it to happen? So, there's two possibilities. One is he's putting on a show. One of these things is a show. One of them is real. The other possibility is they're both real. Now, if they're both real, what could that mean? Think, how could we understand Dad being both angry, right, and being and hoping that it will happen? We'll get back to that in a moment. But whatever the case is, I think Dad's response to this provokes jealousy on the part of the brothers. Why? If you were the brothers, what have you just seen that might make you not just angry, not hatred-filled, but all of a sudden jealous? What have you now seen, right, which you haven't really seen before, that might provoke jealousy? Where does jealousy come from? When am I jealous? That's favoritism, but I already saw favoritism. I saw favoritism the minute that Dad gives him that coat. So I haven't seen favoritism now. For favoritism, I might hate the brother. Right? When am I going to be jealous? I think, I'll tell you what I think. It's affirmation. Right. In other words, Dad, despite himself, has affirmed his belief in the dream. The brothers see from Dad's response, Dad thinks it's real. Right? Dad can say everything he wants, right? But the fact is, Dad's nervous, he thinks it's real. Until now, the brothers don't necessarily believe it's real. Until now, whatever it is, right? So Yosef is acting, you know, we hate him the way he's acting, right? But the fact, but to believe that he's really going to be over us, that there's objective truth, all of a sudden, Dad's response to the second dreams makes it seem like it's really true. All jealousy happens when it might really be true, right? Now I'm jealous of you. Okay, what happens next? Dad is now aware. We'll get back to Dad's ambivalent response in a moment. But Dad is now aware, clearly aware, of tension within the family. Now, how does this affect what happens next? Let's read what happens next. Again, one of the things that gets in the way, I think, of understanding stories in Chumash is the fact that we know them too well. When you know stories too well, you fail to see the surprising parts of them. The Torah is counting on you being surprised when something surprising happens. The problem is we never get surprised because we know all the endings. So it's like telling a joke, you know all the endings. How much can you laugh at an old joke? How much a joke depends upon the element of surprise. I think it's important, if you want to really read Chumash, to preserve the element of surprise, which means you have to actively read. You have to go back and erase everything you know about the story. You have to come to it as if you're a non-frum guy reading the story for the very first time. What are you surprised at as you read the story? So let's read this as if we never heard the story before and see what surprises us. Dad is now aware of the tensions in the family. So the brothers go and they shepherd their sheep in Shechem. They're going towards Shechem to shepherd their sheep. So Yaakov says to Yosef, alright, let's just stop right there. Do you think this is a really good idea? Okay? And not only is this a bad idea, but is this what you would do if you were in Yaakov's situations? You're not an idiot. You've just become aware of seething tension within the family. Is it like the greatest of ideas to be sending Yosef unguarded, alone, off on a mission to check on his brothers? Not only that, right? If you look carefully, there's not even any mission here. Look carefully. Read it. Right? Halo achecha ron b'shem. Aren't your brothers in Shechem? First of all, what's the rhetorical question? Isn't that a little strange? Why not, your brothers are in Shechem? What do you mean, aren't your brothers are in Shechem? Either they're in Shechem or they're not in Shechem. What's the aren't your brothers in Shechem? So that's a little weird. But aside from the rhetorical question, hey, I think your brothers are in Shechem. L'chavesh l'chalem. Why don't you go over there and I think I'll send you to them. First, do you see the lack of mission? There's no mission. Why are you sending me there? Notice that there's two speeches. Yosef indicates his readiness, his response to go, his readiness to go, and now comes the mission. Why don't you check on the sheep? Almost as an afterthought. I mean, if I was doing this, mission comes first. Hey, I need somebody to check on the sheep, Yosef. Would you go to your brothers in Shechem, please, and check on the sheep? No, it's the other way around. Hey, I think your brother's in Shechem. Why don't I send you over there? Okay. Gee, we need something for you to do. Why don't you go check on the sheep, check on the brothers, check on the shalom of this, the shalom of that, the shalom of the brothers, shalom of the sheep. Also, notice how, first of all, what is ominous about this mission? What do we know about the history of Yosef and his brothers and Yaakov that makes this mission incredibly ominous? Why do they hate him? They hate him because he's bringing back Dibasam Ra'al Avim. They hate him because they're bringing back bad reports from the father. What's Dad sending him back to do? Hey, why don't you bring back some reports? Why don't you do what they hate? Why don't you do what they hate? Right? And in case the irony was lost on you, remember how it says they hated him so much? Lo yachlo dabro le shalom. They couldn't even talk shalom to him. Well, what's this mission? Lech na reya shalom achecha, shalom atzon. Why don't you check on their shalom? Not only their shalom, the shalom of the sheep. He can't even talk b'shalom, right? There's no shalom here. So this whole mission, this is a disaster. What is he thinking? Why is he doing this? All right, let's keep on reading. Lech na reya shalom achecha ve shalom atzon, hashivini davar v'yashachem mehem achavron v'yavar shchema. Sends him from Hebron, comes to Shechem. According to the Ramban and others, it was a long way, right? A very far way, and Yosef went all by himself. Okay, now here we have another problem in the text. What's your problem with this? Okay, now, if you were a writer or an editor, you were looking to save some space in the Torah, right? What would you do? I'll tell you what I would do. I would cut out these three psukim. Don't look at me heretically, right? I mean, please don't stone me. All I mean to say is, why do I care about the geography? I care about the geography? In other words, what happens? So he gets to Shechem, can't find him, right? Finds a guy, asks the guy says they went that way, they're in Dothan, he gets to Dothan, finds him there. What would have been so terrible if I didn't hear about how he stopped to ask directions? It's like every time someone stops to ask directions, I need to know, right? Very strange. Just forget about the geography. Whatever. The point is, he was sent to check on his brothers. He went to check on his brothers. When the brothers saw him coming, right, the brothers jumped him. That's the bottom line. I need to know, first he didn't find him, then he went to find him. What's the point? That he was, so maybe it's that he was, you know, bezrizus, he wanted to do what dad was doing. Okay, fine, but it's like a lot of text to tell us something fairly trivial. A little strange. Okay. So, we have a bunch of questions here with Yaakov. What is he doing? Why is he doing this? And what's the story with his ambivalence about the second dream? To get some perspective on this, I'd like to take you back to examine the brother's point of view. Let's leave Yaakov's point of view for a moment, and let's go to the brothers. What are the brothers thinking? The brothers are thinking, we hate this guy. We hate Yosef. Let's look carefully and ask him why they hate him. Where exactly is the brother's resentment coming from? As we've gone through the text, we found four reasons, four explicit reasons for the hatred. It starts with the dibasam ra'ah. It continues with father hating, with father favoring him. It continues with the first dream. It continues with the second dream. All of that is explicit in the text. I would like to argue, though, that above and beyond all of that, there's another reason why they hate him that's implicit in the text and not explicit. That this implicit reason underlies everything else, and is very important for understanding the source of their hatred and out of which everything else grows. What's the implicit reason why Yosef is hated by the brothers? Okay, good. So you see it, first of all, he's a Ben Rachel. Notice that there's sibling rivalry within the family. But it's something more, too. You see it in all the Rashis. This is where the Medrash comes in. The Medrash and the harmony is filling you in on this second, on this other implicit level of hate. You see it in many Rashis. Let's look at some of the first Rashis over here. I don't have time to do all of them, but let's go back for a moment. Did I get rid of it? All right, let's see. Where did Rashi go? Where's the... There we go. Okay. All right. One of the places you see it is over here. Well, let's try another. I'll give you another Rashi. You remember when it says over here... Let me see if I can pull it up for a moment. When the brothers strip him in the... When the brothers throw him in the pit, they strip him of all his clothes. Here's the text. Vayhi kasher bo Yosef el achav vayavshitu at Yosef et kutanto et ketonot hapasim asher alav. Now, let's look at Rashi on that for a moment. Look at Rashi over here. Rashi, the Medrash, is bothered by why it has to say twice the description of his coat. Why does it have to say Vayavshito at Yosef et Kutanto? They stripped him of his coat, right? The beautiful coat that he was wearing. Just say they stripped him of the beautiful coat, whatever. So Rashi says it was two coats. At Kutanto Zecholok, right? Kutanto, one cloak was just the cloak that everyone's wearing. At Kotapasim, Zesha Sifalo Avival Shar Echav. That was the special coat that Dad gave him more than all the other brothers. Okay, now, let me ask you this question. What is Rashi trying to teach me? To me, that is like the most trivial Rashi in the world. Like, I care that they, not only did they take off his overcoat, they took off his shirt too. So, in other words, it wasn't just the beautiful coat he was wearing, it was also his shirt that they took off. Okay, whatever. Like, why do I need to know that? So what is Rashi answering? So Rashi has a big problem and seems to say it twice. What's the answer? He even took off his shirt, not just his cloak. Okay, so what? What's the point of that, Rashi? I think Rashi's telling you something very, very significant over there. Let's go back. What?
They neutralize his advantage.
Well, neutralizing his advantage would just be the overcoat, right? The beautiful coat. What's that? Everybody's mumbling. What are you telling me?
Humiliation?
Could be humiliation. Okay, possible. Let's go back to some other Rashis. I think there's a pattern in the Rashis. In the very beginning, Ela told us Yaakov Yosef. What's the problem? Hello, he's got another 10, 11 children, right? What's the deal with Ela told us Yaakov Yosef? So Rashi in the Medrash is bothered by this. And these are some of the answers that are given by Rashi. Let's look for the common denominator in the answers. Midrash Agada Doresh. Here's the Midrash. Tola Kosov told us Yaakov B'Yosef Mipnei Kama Dvarim. There are a whole bunch of reasons for this, Rashi says. Achas. One. Shekol Atzmo Shel Yaakov Lo Avad Ela Eitzel Lovan Ela B'Rachel. Because from Yaakov's perspective, he only worked for Rachel. Rachel was the wife that he was looking for. And therefore, from Yaakov's perspective, Ela told us Yaakov Yosef is true. There's 10 other kids from a different wife. Doesn't make a difference. That doesn't count, right? Rachel is my main wife. That's the first thing that Rashi says. Second thing, Ushaya ziv okinun shel Yosef domulo. Later on when it says ben zakunim hulo, the Medrash darshans ben zakunim to mean ziv ukinun, which means the way his face looked. It looked facial, his facial features resembled Yaakov's. Okay, that's reason number two. Reason number three, kol ma she'ira liYaakov ira liYosef. Strangely enough, whatever happened to Yaakov in his life, he finds it's happening to Yosef in his life. Zenistam v'zenistam. This one got hated by his brothers. This one got hated by his brothers. Ze'echav v'vaksh l'horgo. This one, his brothers tried to kill him, and this one, his brothers tried to kill him. V'chein harba v'Breishis Rabba. Breishis Rabba goes on more and more about the similarities between Yaakov and Yosef. Let's look for the common denominator in all of those three things. What is Rashi really saying? What is the Medrash really saying when you add up all three? Okay? Often when there's a machlokas, the interesting part about the machlokas is not what they disagree on, it's what they agree on. In this machlokas, everyone's agreeing about one thing, right? It's just the particularities that they're disagreeing with. What are they saying? They're saying, A, Yaakov only worked for Rachel, right? And this is the child of Rachel. B, he looks just like me. C, I find that everything that's happening to me in my life is happening to him. So I'm making this beautiful coat. What's Yaakov's perspective? What is the Medrash telling me Yaakov's perspective towards Yosef is? How is Yaakov treating Yosef? It's not so much that he knows it, right? He suspects it. So what does it mean, what everything goes through Yosef? What are the words that we would use to describe it then?
Successor.
He's a successor. In other words, who is my successor in life? It is Yosef, right? We have a word for a successor. A child among all other children who is a successor. We call it a bechor. That's the traditional role of the firstborn, right? Why does the firstborn get a double portion? He is my main legacy. My legacy travels through my bechor, hopefully. And, of course, the bechor in the Torah is not always your bechor, right? The bechor kind of travels in strange ways. But nevertheless, Yaakov seems to be treating Yosef as his legator, as the one who is going to carry on his legacy. Look, A, my main wife is really Rachel. B, he looks just like me. This is my legacy. He's carrying on my life in the world. C, not only does he look just like me, everything that happens to me is happening to him. He's carrying on my legacy. Now ask yourself, go back to that Rashi about the coats. Rashi says, oh, guess what? The brothers were stripping him of not just one coat, but two coats. There were two coats. One was a chaluk. That all the brothers had. But then there was another special cloak, Zesha Hosifu Lo Achav Al Shar Achav. There was a double cloak, a second cloak that he had, more than all the other brothers. What does it remind you? Everybody gets one cloak. There's one brother who gets two cloaks. Sure sounds a lot like Pishnayim. Rashi seems to be alluding to the idea that the second cloak was Pishnayim. The second cloak was literally that which crowns him the Bechor, that which makes him the Bechor. Right. It is the double portion. And if you think about it, is Yosef the Bechor or not the Bechor? You say, of course Yosef is not the Bechor. But if you look at it in a certain way, he is. How is Yosef the Bechor? Because he's the Bechor of Rachel. Right? He's the first child of Rachel. That explains what Rashi means when he says, Kol Atzma Shel Yosef Lo Avad Ela B'Rachel. He was always working for Rachel. So Yaakov's view is what? Yaakov's view is, who did I really marry? I married Rachel. I was tricked into marrying Leah. That was just a trick. I always had my eyes on Rachel. So the first child of Rachel is really my Bechor. Okay. Now, if this is really true, and I don't want to assume that's true yet, but let's just say that maybe this is true. If maybe this is true, put yourself in the brother's shoes right now. If this is what's going on, if the meaning of this special coat is not just that Dad likes him more, but Dad is treating him as a Bechor, why might this get you a little upset?
Because he's not.
Well, he is. He's the son of, first the son of Rachel. So he is kind of, but now why are you upset by that news? That's right. The only thing worse than insulting a kid on the playground is insulting his mother. Look at what's happening here. If Yosef is the Bechor, what does that mean about Leah? What does that mean about their mother? It means they are nothing. It's as if they weren't born. It's like no one was born yet until you had Yosef. There's 10 kids that got born before him, and no one was born yet until him. Why? Because she didn't count? Because the only one counted because you were waiting for Rachel the whole time? So Reuven all the way down doesn't count? That's very tough to swallow, right? So beyond everything else, Rashi seems to be painting a picture based upon the Medrash for another level of anger, right? It seems to be a misplaced Bechorah in the brother's eyes. Now, is it really true, or is it just our imagination? Well, let me share with you a bone-chilling series of parallels, which I think suggests it's really, really true. Let's look for a moment in Sefer Devarim. We've been talking about Kishnayim. Let's actually look at the parsha that talks about Kishnayim for a moment. Let's just throw it up on the screen if we have a minute. Let me see if I can find this. There it is. Let's read the parsha. You all know the parsha. Let's read it again, though. If you learned Bava Basra, you learned a lot about this parsha. But let's read this parsha again. And this time, let's think sale of Yosef in the back of our minds. There are a number of words here, which are very strange words, which seem to be really weird words that appear out of the blue. Let's read them for a moment. When a man has two wives, a wife that he loves and a wife that he hates. Anything strange about that phraseology? A wife that you hate? That's a little bit harsh, don't you think? Why isn't it just like a wife that you love and a wife that you don't love quite as much? Torah seems to use very strange language to talk about the wife that's not loved that much. Because any wife that's not loved that much, from her perspective, is what? That's being hated. When you want to know what being hated means, it means if I'm in competition, I'm not loved as much, that's hated. So there is a woman here who is hated. By the way, only one woman in all of Tanakh, one actual woman in all of Tanakh, that was ever described in that very language as a sinu'ah. Who would that be? Leah. There's only one woman that was ever called a sinu'ah, and that's Leah. The Torah is now using that, and the only other unique phrase, time that phrase occurs is right here, now using that terminology. Is that coincidental? Let's keep on reading. A man has two wives, a hated wife and a loved wife. Well, if Snua is Leah, who would the Ahuva be? And who would the man be? Yaakov. V'yaldu lo banim ahuvava Snua. And they have children, this ahuvava Snua. V'ya ben ha-bechor la-snia. Who would that be? The ben ha-bechor to the child that was, to the mother that was, quote, hated. That's Reuven. V'ya b'yom anchilo asbanav. It will happen on the day that he gives his inheritance over to his children. Lo yuchal levaker es ben ahuvav p'nei ben ha-snua b'chor. He shall not make the b'chor, the ben ahuva who is born second, the first child of the second most favored wife. Kiet ha-b'chor ben ha-snua yakir. He instead has to recognize the Bechor ben Asnua, latet lo pishnayim b'chol asher yimatzalo, to give him the double portion and everything that's found to him. Ki hu reishit ono lo mishpat b'chora. He is the first of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. Now, if you read here, you hear other references.
Bayechi.
What is reishit ono doing there? Right? Where do you hear reishit ono in the Torah? Reuven, Bechori, reishit oni. It's another quote. Right, speaking about Reuven, right? He is the one who's Reshit Ono. It's impossible to avoid the fact the Torah seems to be explicitly referring to the case of Yaakov, Rachel, Leah, Reuben, and Yosef. And just in case you aren't convinced, there's other strange language, which is so strange that the Gemara in Bava Basra darshans many halachas from this language because it's strange. There are two words here which are odd in the verse. One of them is Yakir, where it says, Ki ata b'chor ben asnua yakir latet lo pishnayim. He must recognize the b'chor ben asnua to give him the double portion. If the Torah wanted to be more brief, it could have just said, ata b'chor ben asnua yiten pishnayim. Why the extra yakir latet lo pishnayim? He has to recognize him to give him the double portion. Seems to be extra words. So the Gemara darshans all sorts of things from there. But not just yakir, b'chol asher yimatze lo, to give him a double portion, everything that's found to him. Isn't that a strange way of talking? Must give him a double portion, everything that's found to you. Just say, give him a double portion, everything that you have, everything that's his. B'chol asher yeshlo. Why does it say b'chol asher yeshlo? Why is it b'chol asher yimotzelo? Listen to these strange words. Yakir and yimotze. Yakir and yimotze. Now think Mechiras Yosef. Yakir and yimotze. What do the brothers say when they come to dad with that bloody coat?
Hakerna.
Zos matzanu hakerna. We found this, Dad. Recognize it, please. It's Dvarim. Yakir, b'chol asher yimotze lo. It's code words. What is Yakir? Recognizing the true firstborn. What is yimotze lo? Your estate. What are the brothers saying to Dad? Zos matzanu. Dad, here's the coat. Zos matzanu, code words. What does yimotze lo mean in Dvarim? Estate. What are they saying when they present him with the coat? Dad, zos matzanu. This is your estate. We found this. Hakerna. What's code words? What does that mean? Recognize your true Bechor. Hakerna. Haksonas bincha hi imlo. Is it really Yosef's coat? Or not? Maybe it's Reuven's coat. There's a whole level, double layer of meaning to what they're saying. They're not just presenting with a bloody coat. They're saying something which they can't say. Right? They can't say it, so they say it symbolically. But this is what they're saying. And are they right? Torah says they're right. Right? You can't do this. You can't be Mavaka the Ben Ahuva. Their anger has justification. Doesn't mean you can kidnap a brother and sell him into slavery, right? But where they're coming from makes sense. What they saw was what they felt was an injustice in the family that could not be rectified unless they took action. They're taking action. Maybe not the right action, but they're taking action. That's the brother's perspective. Now let's go back to the first questions we asked. Father's perspective. How does this affect Yaakov? So first of all, it affects Yaakov because it means that Yaakov is relating to Yosef differently. How does it change our perspective of the story from Yaakov's perspective once we understand that Yaakov is relating to Yosef as a Bechor? Yaakov's thinking to himself, so put yourself in Yaakov's shoes for a moment. You're Yaakov. What's happening? You're thinking to yourself, I love Rachel, I married Rachel, everything else, you know, whatever, Lavan did this to me, it's all nice kids, but the bottom line is, this is my main kid, and I really think that Yosef's my Bechor. Not only that, but I'm looking around, and he looks like me. And not only does he look like me, but I'm looking at his life, and I'm just seeing it. Everything that's happening to him happened to me. What am I thinking of the fact that he looks like me, and everything that happened to me happened to him? I'm thinking maybe what? Maybe this is a sign. Maybe there's some sort of heavenly sign that he really is my Bechor, because I know deep down I have other kids. I know that Reuben is my firstborn child from Leah, but this is a sign, right? I'm starting to get these indications then maybe Yosef, maybe it's for real. Now, if you're Yaakov and you're ambivalent, you're not really sure if it's for real, but you hope it's for real, that Yosef's your Bechor, you're giving him the coat, what's going to be your reaction to the dream? All of a sudden, there's this dream. You had dreams. They meant something to you. Now this kid has dreams. And the dreams are everyone's bowing to him. What are you thinking in your heart? It's true, right? It's validation. God himself is coming out of the clouds. It's a sign. He really is supposed to be the head of this family. It's the most terrific thing in the world for the first dream. But then all of a sudden the second dream comes. And all of a sudden, he has a conflicted reaction. Vayigar bo aviv, he's angry at the one hand. But hayamamtinu metzapa matai yavol. He's waiting for it to happen. We understand the hayamamtinu metzapa matai yavol. He's waiting for it to happen. Right? He's waiting for it to happen. This is the validation. This is the sign he's been waiting for. This is God himself coming out, confirming with a second dream. It's really true. This child is going to carry on my legacy. There's only one problem. What's the problem with this dream that leads to Vayigar Bo Aviv? The anger, the causticness. It's possible it's Shalom Bayis. It could be it's just a show, but it could be more than just a show. Listen to his words. Havo navo ani v'imecha lishdach avos charetz. So Rashi picks up on the v'imecha, right? You don't have a mother, right? He didn't realize it referred to Bila. So that makes him think that I'm not really sure if this is a dream or not. I'm not sure if this is God, or maybe it's just Yosef's own ego. But more than that, what's the problem? What? The problem is he's there, and what's he doing in this dream? He's bowing down to him. Now think about the proper role for a bechor in the family. What's a bechor supposed to do in a family? A bechor is supposed to be a successor, but not while the father is still alive. A bechor is supposed to be able to carry on the legacy of the father, not supplant the legacy of the father. If this bechor is coming along and having in his dreams, having dreams of mother and father bowing to him, that's not a bechor. That is. That's a part of me who's drunk on his own power. He's not doing what he should be doing. Loyally carrying out the legacy of father. Instead, what's he doing?
Usurping.
He's usurping the legacy of the father. Is this a bechor? Or is this a child who's off on his own? Who's out for himself? Is he loyal to me? Is he there to carry on my legacy? Or is he using me? Is he doing whatever he can to build himself up? The second dream calls that question into relief and leads perhaps to a conflicted reaction on the part of Yaakov. I hope it happens, but what's going on?
But why isn't Yaakov also bothered by the Ben Snua and the Ben Ahuva part?
First of all, that gets written later. That's the narrator of the Torah later on telling us, giving the narrator's comments, God's own commentary on this.
But if the brothers are not using the language, the brothers are already using the language.
No, I don't think that's... This is a subtle point. I don't have time to explain this in detail. But when the Torah uses that language, it's not the pshat that the brothers know what's going to be written in Dvarim. Right? Dvarim hasn't been written. They don't know that. They're not using that language on purpose. It's Dvarim using the language of the brothers to explain to us what the mistake, what the brothers were thinking. It's the narrator commenting on the brothers. It's not the brothers commenting on what he got. The narrator is saying, you want to know what they're saying with that coat? What they're saying with that coat is that the Bechorah doesn't belong to you. That so, but you can't interpolate it the other way. The brothers don't know what's going to be written. I don't know, but you can't assume too much. You try to read the story as just the story. But let's just take the story as a story. Put yourself in Yaakov's shoes, right? Again, try to live in the shoes of the people. You're in the shoes of Yaakov. What's going on in your head? Is this for real? Isn't this for real? All of a sudden, Yaakov has an idea. Let's get rid of Dvarim. All of a sudden, Yaakov has an idea. Aren't your brothers going to Shechem? I think I'll send them to you. Shechem. Also, I'll send you to them. Shechem. Let's think Shechem for a moment, boys and girls. What happened in Shechem? No good things have happened in Shechem. Last thing that happened in Shechem, Shimon and Levi got carried away, destroyed a whole city. Okay? Rashi, by the way, points this out. Let's see if we can call up Rashi. Vayavo Shchema. Rashi on Shchem. Maka Muchan Luperonios. Shchem, not a good place. Shom, which Peronios? Shom, Kilkulu Ashvatim. That's where the brothers made their epic mistake of Mechiras Yosef. Shom Inu Es Dina. That's where the rape of Dina and the massacre of Shechem happened. Sham nechlecha malchus beis David shenemar vayelech rechav an Shechema. If you look in Sefer Malachim, the Davidic dynasty splits in Shechem between Rechavam and Yeravam. Okay, now, let's look at that Rashi again. When you see three different things, what's common about them is often more interesting than what's different about them. Think about what's common. Is there a common denominator between these three things?
Strife.
Strife. What kind of strife? On what grounds does the... Between... Who does the Malchus split between in Shechem?
Yosef.
Between Yosef and his brothers. It's between the children of Rachel and the children of Leah. That's what splits in Shechem later on. And that's what splits in Shechem with the sale of Yosef. And now think about the rape of Dinah. You think it's any coincidence that when Dinah is introduced with the rape of Dinah, the Torah goes out of its way to tell you, Batetze Dinah Bas Leah? Why do I need to know she was a Bas Leah? If you didn't know that Dinah was a Bas Leah, you weren't paying attention from before. Just say Batetze Dinah. Why Dinah Bas Leah? And what was Yaakov's response to that rape? He didn't say anything. He didn't do anything until the brothers came home. V'hecherish Yaakov ad Boam. He was absolutely silent. By the way, hecherish from the Parsha of Vavaris Nadarim, im hecherish yacherish la yishab yom shamo. What does lahacherish mean in that context?
To tacitly
assent. If by your silence you tacitly assent, then the Nadarim are there. By his silence, what do the brothers think he's doing? Tacitly assenting. So when they come home, they're furious. What's going on, right? And they act and they overreact. And Yaakov gets mad at them for overreacting. And what's the response of the very last line of the episode? Hachazona yase etzachosenu. Why didn't you react? The father should have reacted. We're going to allow our sister to be made into a zona over our dead body. We, the children of Leah, had to react. The first glimmers of a split in the family along the lines of children of Leah seemed to be the rape of Dinah, which ended in a massacre. The strife between the children of Leah and the children of Yosef explodes in Mechiras Yosef, and it explodes on the national stage in the Chiluk of Malchus Beis David. It all happens in Shechem. Right? Shechem is a bad place. It's a bad place. It's the place where the family breaks apart. Why don't you go to Shechem? Right? And what are you going to do in Shechem? I don't even have a mission for you. Let's go back and look at these, and look at Yosef's response. Where are we? Earlier. I think I'll send them to you. Yosef says, here I am. No mission. Would you go to Shechem for me if I asked you to? Hineni. Yosef knows, as Rashi and the other Mepharshim point out, that Shechem is a dangerous place. This is not a good mission. But he's being sent to do the thing that got him into trouble in the first place. Hineni, as Rashi says, Lashon Zrizus, right? He's ready to go. Hineni. What other parsha in the Torah does that remind you of? A person being sent on a very dangerous mission, who answers Hineni. Sure sounds a lot like the Akedah. Sure sounds a lot like the Akedah. The Akedah. What was the Akedah? It was a great?
Nisayon.
And in English?
Test.
Test of what? Test of Avram's loyalty. Would Avram give everything up, even the most precious thing, if God asked him to? God is testing Avram's loyalty. How much do you love me? How much are you loyal to me? What's Yaakov doing with Yosef? Yaakov is now in the position where he needs to test Yosef's loyalty. He can't figure it out. Is this kid in it for himself? Or is he in it for me? Is he loyal? A real Bechor is loyal, carries out my legacy. The only way I know, let me give him a mission in which his own interests diverge from my interests. What greater mission would that be than sending him to all alone to Shechem? Would he really go? If he would go, he's loyal. Would he give up? Would he put himself in great danger for me? Now, of course, Yaakov wouldn't want anything bad to happen to him. Enter the geography lesson. Where are the brothers really? They're in Dothan. Shechem was just the first stop. It's possible that Yaakov knew their itinerary, right? They're going, they're on their way, right? They're really in Dothan. What's he doing? Would you go to Shechem for me? And when you get to Shechem, what do? Hashiveni Davar. Go bring me back word. So go to Shechem. Here's the mission. Go to Shechem. Come back. Okay. Yaakov's thinking, what's going to happen when he gets to Shechem? He'll find nobody and he'll come back. That's what's supposed to happen. But he's proven it. It's an Akedah story. Of course, I'm not going to let him kill him. It's just like the Akedah. It's not, we're not going to fall apart. On the other hand, if he goes, if he comes back, I know that this kid's for real. By the way, what other Akedah language do you have in the story? Just in case you're wondering if it's really an Akedah. How about this? Look at this language over here. Where'd my mouse go? Here, wait. Here we go. Yud Ches. Anybody? Vayiru es hamakam erachok. They saw the place from afar. Sure sounds a lot from like Vayara Samakam Erachok. When Avram sees, by the way, and it's the same idea, isn't it? What does Avram see from afar? The place of doom. The place where everything's gonna fall apart. What do the brothers see when they see Yosef coming? They see doom approaching. It's right? That's what's gonna happen. Does it continue? Look at this language. Reuven. Reuven says, we're not going to do this. Yad al tishluchu bo. Anybody? Malach. Al tishluch yad chalanar. Same idea. What does the Malach do? Saves him. What does Reuven do? Saves him. Same language. Right? Does it continue? Keep on reading. Then Yehuda has another plan. No, we're not going to kill him. We'll just send him to the Ishmaelim. When they see the Ishmaelim coming, Vayisu Einayim Vayiru Vihine, Orchos Ishmaelim Bayim Megilad. What does this remind you of? Vayisa Eina Vayar, Avram lifts up his eyes, Vihine, and there, behold, there's an ayil, right? There's a ram. What was the ayil? It was a substitute. It was an alternative. We don't have to kill him, we can kill the ram. What's Yehuda proffering with these Ishmaelim? It's an alternative. We don't have to kill him. We can sell him. Everything that happens in this story follows the trajectory of the Akedah. Yaakov's making a grand Akedah plan. It's only one problem. God made the Akedah, and Yaakov is the one making this Akedah. Can a human being make an Akedah story? What happens when a human being makes an Akedah story? So Yaakov has it all worked out. I'm going to send Yosef. He's going to go to Shechem. He's going to come back, brothers in Dothan. What happens? What happens is, he gets there, Vayimtsa'eyu Ish, and some guy finds him. Zok Rashi, who's the guy? It's a Malach. A Malach, think Akedah, boys and girls. What does a Malach do in an Akedah story? What is God saying to all of this? What God's saying to this, all this is, oh, we're playing Akedah. Okay, I can get into the act. We can all play Akedah. Every good Akedah story comes with a Malach, right? What does the Malach do if we're playing Akedah? Well, you forgot about the Malach. What does the Malach do? The Malach takes the designs of the sender and completely confounds them, right? No, don't do that. So what Malach? One guy, right, in Shechem, moseying along, just one line, all he has is, oh, you're looking for them? They went that way, right? Here's my Malach. You can't play Akedah. You can't control whether he comes back to you. You can't control the uncontrollable. We'll really play Akedah. We'll have a Malach, and then we'll have Reuven sing Yad Al Tishluchubo, just like the Akedah, and then we'll have Vayisaina Vayar, and we'll have the whole thing, all of the language of the Akedah. But God hijacks the Akedah. It completely spins out of control, right? And there's nothing that Yaakov can do about it. It's just, right, it's an Akedah story. Okay, we're just about out of time. Where's Robert? We're just about out of time? 5 minutes? Okay. All right. Turns out, there's one more story that has echoes in all of this. What's the other story? One other. When, let me point you to the relevant psukim for a moment. When Yaakov sends him, okay, you ready? Vayishalchehu me'emek Chevron vayavosh Shema. He sends him from Emek Chevron, and he comes to Shechem. And then all of a sudden, vayimtzeu shvinei toa basada. In that line right there, there are three references to another story earlier in Brachos. Vayishalchehu me'emek Chevron vayavosh Shema. Just meditate on that. Make that a mantra and ask yourself what other stories it remind you of. Vayishalchehu me'emek Chevron vayavosh Shema. Vayimtzeu ish vinei toa basada. Vayishalchehu me'emek Chevron vayavosh Shema. Vayimtzeu ish vinei toa basada. Anybody? Actually, Cain v'Hevel, there are resonances of, but not here. But anybody else? It's in the field. Now listen carefully. These three words. Let's isolate the three words. Vayishalchehu Shema toa. Vayishalchehu Shema toa. It's hard to realize, it's hard to figure it out, because the Torah disguises it by re-vowelizing one of the words. One of the words has a different meaning because it gets vowelized differently. Let's keep on reading. You'll see it in another verse too. Very good. It's in Yishmael. It's Shichma with Yishmael. Where do you have Vayishalchehu Shichma and Toa? Right? With Yishmael. That's right, in Vayera. There it is. Vayashkim Avram Baboker, Vayikach Lechem, Vachemas Mayim, Vayitin al Hagar, Sum al Shichma. That's a Yeled. There's Shichma. But Shchema has changed to shoulder. Before Shchem was a city, it was a shoulder. Shchema. Bes hayelad vayishalcheha. You see that word? Right? Vatelech vateta. And then she goes and she wanders. Three words in one sentence, three words in one sentence. Right? So, when Avram sends Hagar, sounds a lot like, Hagar and Yishmael, sounds a lot like Yaakov Avinu sending Yosef. If you were wondering whether it's real, keep on reading in the next pasuk. Vayichlu amayim min achemet. And then there was no more water left in the canteen. Vatashle chasayela tachas achad esichim. So she cast the child underneath one of the brandle branches. Vatelech vatashav la mineged. And then she sat down, far away. Ki amra al erev emot ayela, because she didn't want to see the death of the child. What does this remind you of in the story of Mechiras Yosef? Anything? First of all, let me ask you a question. What did he send her with? He sent her with bread and water, right? Then the water gets used up. What happened to the bread? That's the correct answer. We don't know what happened to the bread, but it's irrelevant. Who cares about the bread? Point is, there's no water. So the bottom line is, there might be bread around, but it's irrelevant. The point is, there's no water. So think about this for a moment. There's bread around, but there's irrelevant. But there's no water. And in that context, a family member takes another family member, casts them down, and goes and sits from afar. That's right. It's a borek in bomayim. Okay? Look at that pasuk in Mechiras Yosef. Whoops, did I get rid of it? I get rid of it. We'll do it in PowerPoint. If you color code it. Right? Here's Mechiras Yosef. Here is, right? Here's Yishmael. Right? Both Yishmael and Yosef are sent by their fathers on a journey. One journey is to Shoulder, one journey is to Shechem, so to speak. But neither journey works out the way they thought. They get lost. This depends upon a certain way of reading the story of Avram, but you ever wonder why Avram just sent her with, like, it seems so cruel. Avram's such a nice guy. Why send her with just a canteen of water and a loaf of bread? Well, Sarai had demanded Garsheha, right? Vayigarsheha to Garesha Sa'amazos. What does she in fact do? What does he in fact do? Vayishalcheha sends her, right? If I send her, right? What happens if I send somebody and I'm not expelling them really, and I'm only giving them bread and some water? Right? Maybe they'll come back. Was Avram thinking maybe they'll come back? But of course she doesn't come back. She gets lost. Yosef doesn't come back either. He gets lost. Keep on reading. Right? She sits from afar, right? Just like the brothers sit from afar. And then, of course, Haborek ein v'mayim, v'yichlu amayim menachem. There's no water, but is there bread? Well, what are they eating? What are the brothers eating? V'yeshvu lecho lechem. They're eating bread. There's irrelevant bread, right? But there's no water. Well, who should show up in the sale of Yosef to scoop Yishmael out? And excuse me, to scoop Yosef out and take him away to Mitzrayim. Oh, it's the Yishmaelim. Look at that. Yishmael's back. Right? It is the Girish Yishmael. What's the Torah saying? And with this I'll close. I think the Torah is saying the following. Go back to the two coats. There were two coats. Zesho Sifu lo Aviv al Sharechav. There was the special coat that meant he's the Bechor. There was the regular coat that all the brothers had. What did the brothers strip him of? Both coats. If all that was happening was they were stripping him of the Bechor, which is why they were angry, they would have just stripped him of the Ksonas. But they're not. They're stripping him of both coats. What's the symbolic message of stripping him of even the undercoat? Even the one we all share. What are they really saying? You're not our brother. Forget the Bechor. You're not even our brother. They're stripping him of his credentials to be a brother in the family. What is that? It's Girish Yishmael. Yaakov Avinu might have thought he had an Akeda story on his hands. But once God hijacks the Akeda, from the brother's perspective, what kind of story is this? This isn't the Akeda, this is Girish Yishmael. Right? And the question that haunts Yosef throughout the rest of the story, I think, is he out of the family? The brothers think so. The dad thinks so. Yosef has no way of knowing. Dad didn't think so. But that's the tension of the story, I think. Is Yosef coming back? Right? Or is this really a Girish Yishmael? Okay, gentlemen, it's been really nice seeing you.